This is Screen Divers. On this week's episode, we are covering Krampus, a film released in 2015. The movie runs for 98 minutes, phenomenal running time. Every movie should be no more than 90 minutes, in my opinion. It is a co-production between the United States and New Zealand. Features the music of Douglas Pipes, worth mentioning because this movie is a great, great score, which we are going to discuss later. And it's directed by Michael Dougherty. If you're a horror fan, you know him because he's the director of Trick or Treat. And it's a classic. It's written by Todd Casey, Michael Dougherty, and Zach Shields. And it featured a stellar cast featuring Adam Scott, Toni Collette, David Koechner, Alison Tolman, Conchita Farrell, MJ Anthony, Stefania LaVie, and Krista Stadler. The cinematography is by Jules O'Loughlin, and it's edited by John Axelrod. How are you, Steve?
I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad. How are you, Ricky?
I'm good.
Holy shit, Steve. What happened, Ricky?
That's not Ricky. Who's who? Michelle? What are you doing here?
So this is our Christmas month. We invited Michelle, one of our fearless companions from the Friends of Our Weekly camp. What is Friends of Our Weekly? Well, it's a VIP circle for another phenomenal podcast that if you're not listening to, you should be listening to that. In fact, don't listen to this. Go listen to that. We're talking about Horror Weekly. If you support the podcast, you get to be a part of the VIP circle called Friends of Our Weekly. And Michelle is another member of that circle. She's opinionated to the point that we thought, let's have her on the show every once in a while. Because she's a handful. In a good way. This month was our Christmas month, and we had already a few picks. I had horror comedy. I had Trapped in Paradise. Steve, yep. What did you pick?
Oh my god, that was last week, and we recorded it. And my brain.
You don't remember what you picked?
You guys did Batman Returns.
What's wrong with you? Batman Returns.
Yes, that was your Christmas action pick. I'm not editing this, man.
It stays in. It's Christmas. Everything's been manic.
Yeah, okay. Everything's allowed. It's fine. And this was Michelle's pick. And the theme was Christmas horror. Now, because this is Ricky's job, Michelle, what's this movie about?
This movie it's about a boy named Max Engel who is trying to hold on to the Christmas spirit, even though everyone around him seems to have lost it. And the extended family members are coming to his house to celebrate Christmas. And it's the kind of family everybody has where you don't really have a lot in common. You don't really like them and you're straining to, get along. And after an argument at dinner, Max finally, has had enough of all of it. And he tears up a letter that he has written to Santa. And when that unleashes, Krampus and brings him and this blizzard to the town. And he lays siege to everyone.
That is it. Yeah,
absolutely. And I got to tell you, I was a bit apprehensive about this because I watched this movie with under the recommendation of a couple of friends of ours, Nick and Consuelo. I don't know if we mentioned them before in the show.
I think we have way back.
Longstanding friends of ours, and they are horror heads. Like, they go to Fright Fest every year, whatever. And I remember in 2016, they were like, you need to watch this. We need to watch Krampus. And I never realized that my friend Consuelo has something that could be akin to a fetish. Because now, every year, they go to Vienna. Is it Vienna where Krampus not? They go to...
Salzburg.
Austria.
Salzburg.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's an Austrian thing, right? So they go to it Salzburg, Michelle? Krampusnacht? Did I say it correctly? You've got some German blood.
Krampusnacht is correct.
Well, they kind of roll the R, which I'm not. I can't roll my R, so they, so it's more like the rolling R Krampus.
You need to Krampus. Krampus.
Krampus.
Yeah.
Krampus.
My sister lived in Germany for 11 years, and she didn't know how to roll her R's either. So she was never really able. She's fluent in German, but you can always tell she's American. Like you could always tell she was American because she couldn't quite get that, couldn't quite get that pronunciation.
Look, this is an American take on a I don't want to call it beloved, but it's a folktale. It's an Austrian folktale. And apparently, Krampus is the shadow of St. Nick, right? Of St. Nicholas.
Mm, yeah, but that's the idea, but it predates.
What is it?
Okay, so...
Because Michelle's Krampus... making noises as well, like, I've done my research, you're talking shit. What is it? Tell me.
Krampus predates the St. Nick mythology. That's it.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I believe it. Yeah.
That's kind of what I read too. That it seems to have like Norse origins. That it's like this. He's like the son of hell or something like that. Yeah. And was part of winter solstice.
Look, I think I sent you guys a picture. I collect board games. Modern board games. And lately, I was hunting down for. All right, let me give you some context. There's a series of board games called Horrified. And the latest iteration, now I think the license for the IP for these games, which are great, it's a cooperative experience, akin to Pandemic, if you ever played Pandemic. And it's the latest entry is called World of Monsters. And Ravensburger, which is the publisher globally, in order to promote the latest entry in this franchise, if you pre-ordered the game, you would get an expansion for it. And the expansion was Krampus.
Nice.
Now, there was an uproar for some weird people online about St. Nicholas being depicted as black. I looked, and apparently there's recorded history attesting to the fact that St. Nicholas originally was dark-skinned.
Yeah.
So I really wanted to go on this message board and go, the problem's with you, buddy. Because he was like, frankly, I find it offensive that Santa is black. I'm like, it's not Santa, it's San Nicholas, and you're a fucking racist prick. How about that? What does it matter? It's like, well, you think Jesus was white? That's another thing as well, but we're not going to go there. All right?
Yeah.
Not many white people in the Middle East. That's the reality of things. But anyway, going back to what this movie is about, I forgot how entertaining this was.
Yeah.
Because... I was a little bit, after watching in 2016 with Consuelo Nick that I mentioned earlier, I was like, I don't know if this requires another viewing. And I rewatched it today and I thoroughly enjoyed it. The pace is furiously.
It's great. It's really quick. You can watch it. I mean, both myself and Mary watch it pretty much every single Christmas.
Like a Christmas tradition.
Yeah.
What about you,
Michelle?
Me. Well, I didn't see it in the theater because... it's PG-13 horror, it's going to be dumb. And of course it's my dad who said, this movie's great. You got to see it. And it's been a family staple since it's a yearly watch for sure. The director said he intentionally wanted it to be a PG-13 horror movie because he wanted, it to be a family Christmas movie and to be this generation's Gremlins, where it's yep. much scarier than what the rating indicates. And these monsters, like the toys and, are really fucking scary.
Look, we are going to discuss. I mean, that's what we're here, but I couldn't stop drawing parallels today. I brought in my notes. There's homages paid to Puppet Master here, to Home Alone, to Gremlins, to Evil Dead. There's one scene in particular, Evil Dead 2, sorry. There's one scene in particular where David Cockney, which I adore, is one of those character actors that makes me die. Like, he's super funny. And also quite sinister if he wants to be. Mm. I don't know if you've seen a movie with him called Cheap Thrills.
Oh, guys, what the fuck? Yeah.
Rectify.
Oh, my
this,
God.
Please.
No, I've seen it.
Yeah, but so, Michelle hasn't. It's good. So don't, that's not Michelle. You need to watch it. And then it's a dark comedy, but real dark.
It's
borderline horror thriller, but David Cockney is in the cast and is featured prominently throughout the movie.
Cheap Thrills.
Don't watch a trailer either. Walk in cold, because that's what I did. I walked in cold.
I won't.
It's great. But there's a scene with him whenever Howie Jr., the brat,
yep.
gets taken. Ian all of a sudden is with the shotgun and he wants to go out and he points the shotgun at Tom, which is Adam Scott's character. So he's like, that's it, I'm going out. And right after he goes out and the door closes behind him, there's a blizzard and he's going, he's shouting his son's name. And it reminded me of the sequence with the Hillbilly in Evil Dead 2 when he's looking for Bobby Joe. Yeah. She's outside going, Bobby Joe! It's the same. So it's got to be an homage. You know, I don't think it's lifted, but it's an homage. I also didn't notice a bunch of stuff. Like, you guys have noticed that, what is it? Clumpy, Lumpy, and you know the three, you know the three gingerbread men?
Gingerbread men, yeah.
Do you know who voiced those? No.
It's Seth Green.
Yes.
Justin Roiland from
Rick and Morty. Rick and Morty canceled.
And I'm not sure that the third, I didn't know there was a third one, but I know those two.
I think it's Brian Burns. He's done some voiceover work, but he's probably brought in by Seth Green. It seems to me that these guys have worked together on Robot Chicken. I don't know if you remember the show.
Yeah.
I assume that Brian Burns is a member of that trio as well. Extremely funny. And you can hear Roiland and Seth Green. You can really hear them if you pay attention. Like, it's just a bunch of noises. There's no dialogue that they speak. You know, it's three gingerbread men, literally.
And you've got to give a big thumbs up to Weta Digital, Weta, for the puppets. I mean, like, this is all...
Is that Peter Jackson's...
Yeah. So mm-hmm. one of the key things why it was made in New Zealand was to stay close to Weta. And to produce everything there. That entire Black Friday sale at the beginning was shot in one day in a mall in New Zealand.
I got to tell you something about the opening sequence of this movie.
That's so well done.
It's very good. And as I was watching it today, this was made in 2015, so it's a world that predates the popular usage, you know, by the end user of when it comes down to AI, applying AI to videos. And I don't know why that entire opening sequence felt like one of those AI reels that you get on social media. For whatever reason, because obviously it's topsy-turvy and it's shot in a way that makes everything look quirky and weird. But it's the opening of this movie is fucking phenomenal, man.
It's great.
Like, yeah, it shits on Christmas on every level. Yeah. Like, as you should, technically. When but it comes down to the fanfare of, you know, consumerism. That's
And it shows the fact that nobody in that entire scene
is having a good being time,
nice. they're not being nice. They're all naughty.
Yeah,
that's the straightforward thing that we have to think about straight away. It's great.
No, it's a great opening sequence. Man, I didn't realize on the first viewing either. Michelle, did you know that Omi, which by the way, I thought it was the grandmother. No, that's Tom's mom, right?
That's Tom's mom. Yeah.
The actress that plays Omi is actually like a veteran Austrian actress.
Yeah. When I looked up her
Christine Stadler,
IMDb, there
were a
whole bunch of movies and television shows that, you know, in German.
She's done a ton of German TV,
popular
German TV, so she must be well known in Germany and Austria. I'm pretty sure, for sure. There's little bits as well that I didn't realize on the first viewing that are fucking hilarious. One of them is Howie's character, played by, again, by Cockner. Whenever the hummus is destroyed, he goes, Lucinda!
No!
So he's named the fucking car. It's ridiculous. Tony Collette as well. Man, this movie had a total budget of, I think, 6 million.
It's cheap.
That. And the fact 16, that... sorry, 16? 16? Million. Yeah, and it made, it grossed, when it opened, it grossed like 62 million. So it's a success.
It's a big
purely
success.
Possibly solely on the basis of the fact that this is a beloved celebration in an entire country. So even if it was an American take on it, people went to see it. You get guaranteed. And very clever move, it was released on December 4th. And Krampusnacht is on December 5th. So that's, I think that was a nice touch. Whoever did it correctly.
Yeah, so they did actually go through a process of trying to release it in November. and they postponed it to the 4th to coincide.
Whoever did that,
yeah,
that is perfect. Keep their job because they know what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
100%. Absolutely. Like,
smash that bell.
I read an article too that it's had a real resurgence with on streaming. That's, you know, that's great too, that people that missed it in the theater, like now it, you know, 10 years later, people are discovering it on
absolutely.
I think it's on
like
HBO.
Steve said, a lot, there's probably an entire generation that has adopted this as their, you know, comfort Christmas movie as well, which is,
yeah,
it's great. You know, it's great. It will stand the test of time for sure. You know, almost 10 years have passed. So I was thoroughly entertained today. And as I'm watching it, I'm looking at this kid and I'm thinking, holy shit, I sent this kid recently, but he's 9 years older. I was reaching for my phone and I went, nah, let me think. And then all of a sudden I almost scared the shit out of Anna. It was next to me. I went, aha, I know where I've seen this kid. And she goes, okay, where did you see this kid? So, MJ Anthony, which is the kid that plays Max, he plays the main character, the protagonist, in a show that I think people haven't discovered yet. And it's a damn shame. First of all, Bruce Campbell is in the show in question. You get the female actor, the actress that plays the mother or the matriarch in... I can't remember her name.
I know what you're going to say.
Modern Family. It's
in Modern Family.
Julie Bowen.
Yeah, Julie Bowen. And the show in question is Hysteria.
Which is on Peacock.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's quite good.
Fantastic.
Man.
I've only watched the first two episodes so far. So it's got that horror vibe to
it. It's a take on
it's
the,
a take. Okay.
The mass hysteria of stuff like Satanic Panic in a little town. Yeah. Michelle, are you watching the show?
No, I've been waiting to watch it with my dad because, you know,
please
with Bruce Campbell. And so we'll get on top of that.
It goes, there's a bit of a slump mid-season, but the show is very good. It's good, it's entertaining, it's funny, and it's, you know, it's something. So for our listeners as well, go and look for the show. It's called Hysteria. The other actor that stood out here, obviously, Toni Collette. I mean, I got to say, out of all Australian actors, she never slips, man. Her accent, I mean, at least I can't hear it. I couldn't hear it.
Her
American accent is flawless, dude.
Absolutely flawless.
Is it? But Michelle is from the States. She can tell us. To us, it's flawless, but is it?
I was actually impressed by the kids because other than MJ Anthony, the kids are all New Zealand. You know, they're all from New Zealand. Yeah,
really?
all the kids except for, they're all from New Zealand. So, and I couldn't, I often wondered if that was why Howie Jr. never talked, because I wondered if he like just couldn't master the American accent. So they just had him, so they just didn't give him any speaking lines because he just couldn't, you know, just couldn't do it. But yeah, that's, I mean, yes, of course, Toni Collette did a great job, but I was mostly impressed with the fact that you can't tell the kids are from New Zealand.
I gotta say, it's worth staying on the cast here a little bit because I look, as formulaic as a piece of shit of a show it was, and I'm about to mention 2 and a Half Men, Conchata Farrell, who plays Auntie Dorothy in this, she played Bertha in the show. She was a regular in the show. We lost her, by the way. I keep saying she was, because we lost her last year, I think.
2020. Yeah, it's
2020. She died.
Yeah,
has it been that long? Time flies.
1943 to 2020.
Yeah, she's phenomenal. She's always, you know, larger than life. I mean, she kills 2 baddies in this one with a shotgun, doesn't she?
Yeah.
And also she utters one of the best lines in this, which I'm going to incorporate into my Christmas lexicon. And it's a little sugar, a little spice.
Spice.
Everything nice. Remember that? And she's putting the snaps in the...
Snaps. The peppermint schnapps is perfect.
Yeah, teaching the kids how to make peppermint schnapps, and then giving her drink to Howie Jr. Like that's how I got my first alcohol.
The script of this movie, it's not a masterclass in dialogue or storytelling, but it's a pretty straightforward story, and it's a Christmas movie, and it works, and it's super entertaining. When it came down to the bare bones of the narrative, I really like how they revealed some of the family connections among these people, because we get to know them real fast. And obviously there's no time for character development, but when she's introduced, you'll think, is this their mother? And why is she calling it Dorothy? And then it's revealed later, there's the implication that Aunt Dorothy raised both of them because something happened to their mother. But this is not, it's given to you without hand-holding. And I actually quite like that, because a movie like this will over-explain fucking everything. And in fact, there are a couple of sequences in which this happens. At the end of the day, don't forget that this is fish in a barrel. Yeah? Like, there's a blizzard, we're stuck here together. You know, this is a trope that was used in anything as great as The Shining, from anything as timeless as Night of the Living Dead, even The Boarding of the Windows. It's a trope. There's nothing original about that. But it works. It really does. And some of the tension in some of the sequences really, really, really works as well.
Yeah.
It manages to be funny as much as it manages to be unsettling without blood.
I have to say, Adam Scott does really good job of bringing the kind of comedy to the horror.
Yeah, no, yeah, he does. Perfect. Him and Costner really fucking
play off each other very well.
I thought Aunt Dorothy was the funniest one. She just always had a perfectly timed comment to what was going on.
Don't forget she was on Two and a Half Men for 9 seasons, I think. You remember who she played, right? She played Charlie Sheen's housemaid.
Mother? Oh, yeah.
No. She's a maid.
Don't know anything. I know very little about that show.
My biggest memory from Conchata is Edward Scissorhands, another Christmas movie.
Was she in that as well?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, shit. Yeah.
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 Yeah, she was one of the neighbors, one of the gossipy neighbors.
Gossy neighbors. Yeah.
I need to revisit that. It's been years now. It's been years. Yeah. Before recording today, I did have a conversation with Michelle behind the scenes, and I said, I'm gonna go on and on and on about Adam Scott. I mean, most people know Adam Scott because of Parks and Rec. That launched him into the zeitgeist and into stardom.
That's one of my favorite shows of all time.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. But also, it's the beginning of him being typecasted.
Yeah.
I think. Because he plays the role of the, you know, kind of almost milquetoast nice guy really well. However, I remember him, and this is when I went, holy shit, this guy's funny, and he doesn't have to do much on screen to be funny. He was basically the lead in a show called Party Down. And if you have not seen Party Down, it was about a catering company. They did a revival recently, but the first 2 seasons are fucking gold. I mean, he gets to bounce off Martin Starr, he gets to bounce off Jane Lynch, who's a phenomenal female comedian. And Michelle, do you remember the name of the actress that played a young Kathy Bates in, you know, the Misery?
Lizzie Kaplan?
Yes, Lizzie Kaplan's in that show as well. And it's basically about a catering company. They're all struggling actors, and they're doing this job to make ends meet until they get their big break. It's called Party Down, and it's fucking hilarious. I couldn't recommend it any more than I am right now. Michelle, do you agree?
Yes.
Steve,
yes,
get on it.
It's good.
You need to watch it.
Yeah. Okay. It's good.
Absolute gold. Timeless. It's really well written.
You know, this film is part of a series and interconnected.
Well, would this be the first movie?
But, in the director's commentary for this movie, he actually states it's part of the same universe.
Oh.
Yeah. So.
Oh, the monster part of the Monsterverse?
Yeah, his little Monsterverse. They're all part of his Michael Dougherty connected universe. He did a couple of shorts as well for Trick or Treat, Father's Day, Trick or Treat. Oh my God, I can't remember the other one.
How many tabs have you got open, Steve?
I've got 4 tabs.
What? What? I'm just trying to get to.
It's fine. So Trick or Treat, Making Friends, Trick or Treat, and then Krampus, which was the next movie off the end of this one. So, I believe he did something called Dead Time Stories, which is also connected.
Well, look, I can tell you that, you know, I mean, I'm not blaming him, but he didn't he do the last Godzilla versus King Kong, whatever, the massive movie blockbuster or something lately?
Yeah,
but what was it called? King of Monsters or something?
Yeah,
he did.
Look at my tabs.
Hang on, Godzilla, King of Monsters.
King of Monsters and King of Godzilla. Monsters.
And he
it's a story. A big paycheck.
Godzilla versus Kong.
No, why not? Why not? So, why would you?
Well, no, I'm saying his story. So he's done the stories. Yeah. But he also did...
He directed the latest one. He wrote one of them.
Screenplay?
Yeah. He wrote... Look further down the tab. Look.
He wrote Godzilla versus Kong, or it says story for Godzilla versus Kong, screenplay and story, Godzilla King of Monsters.
And which is the one that he directed?
He directed Godzilla King of Monsters.
There you go. I did not realize that.
Yeah.
I did not realize that.
I want to watch it just solely on the premise of this one. As much as how the fuck are you going to watch another Godzilla movie after Godzilla Minus One? Unless you're a child, how are you going to enjoy another Godzilla movie that has that emotional and dramatic kind of pathos layer over
it? You really can't.
No, but if you want to sell toys,
make some cash on the side.
Yeah.
But then again, he did write the screenplay for X-Men 2 and also Superman Returns. Nice. Easy.
Now, Michelle, you've got notes about this. There's an actress in this that is wildly underused. The actor in question is Alison Tolman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, last time I remember seeing in something prominent, it was something, I think it was the first season of the episodic version, the episodic drama for Fargo, the adaptation for television. Do you remember from something else?
I remember from Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And the Castle Rock TV series.
Yeah.
She was in Castle Rock as well. She does the Minnesota accent quite well.
Yeah.
I mean, again, people from Minnesota might not think so. But I think so. But what the fuck do I know? Anyway, she was a little bit underused because she's got comedic prowess. So, I really like the subtlety of some sequences, and they usually hand it to Toni Collette's performance. They shine through her performance.
There's also a lot of love between the two of them later on as well. You can see that there is a sisterly bond. So, in that sense.
But whenever there's a subtle emotion to be conveyed, it seems that they gave that job, when it comes down to the entire cast, to Toni Collette, because she does that just with her eyes. And I'll give you an example. There's a bit right after they're trying to pull Howie Jr. out of the...
Oh, God.
That entire sequence, man, with Krampus fishing with a gingerbread man attached to a hook.
Fantastic.
You know, like, even the way that kid was shot reminded me of the fat kid in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Yeah.
That's, yes, 100%.
Yeah. They did that bell. Intentionally. They did that intentionally.
And wasn't he Bavarian or German as well?
Like, I can't remember the boy's last name, but.
Gloop. Augustus Gloop.
Augustus Gloop. But anyway, after that sequence, you can see that they're trying, like, all of a sudden, Howard, before he does his entire thing, like, I'm going out with the shotgun, you know, machismo bullshit, whatever, and he's decided he's going to go out in the blizzard. He's accusing Omi of talking shit. It's like, enough of this folklore. Do you believe this bullshit story? And you can see the camera turns to Toni Collette's eyes. She's just seen something that basically has rocked their entire sense of reality, because she had a fucking coming to life gingerbread man shouting at her in the, and it's something that it was meant to be funny, but she goes from, okay, this is kind of comedic, to I'm fucking traumatized, and, you know, I don't know what's real anymore. And it's the first time that you see her act that, because she doesn't say a word. She's just sitting against this piece of furniture with people towering over her, trying to get a word out of her. And she's not saying anything because she's in shock. And she's in shock because she's been traumatized by a gingerbread man that came to life. Like, if you read this, this is not something out of a horror movie. This is something out of an animated film.
Yeah.
And in this one, it's fucking... It just straddles that line, that threshold between fucking funny and terrifying. It's... She does that very well. And then remind me of this point that I'm making when we discuss the end of this movie.
I also want to just mention the simple fact that that dramatic pause where Howie Jr. takes a bite of a gingerbread man for the first time.
Oh, it's
and then it switches. It is so perfect.
It is.
Just enough to just keep you going, what the fuck's going to happen? Sorry to swear, but yeah.
No, that's all right. You just... apologize for swearing. This is
like, yeah,
this podcast is a toilet. So. What are you talking about? We are filthy, man.
We are.
Michelle, anything you want to lead with? Come on, all this research. Tell us. Tell us why you picked this movie. Tell us if you remember the first time you watched this movie. Talk. Talk. Tell us everything.
I was nervous when you asked me to pick the, you know, Christmas horror movie, because I was like, what if they think Krampus is stupid?
Can I tell you something? You must be a clairvoyant, because that's the first thing I thought of. When you told me, I went, fuck this. Why this should be Krampus? I'm going to have to let her. And until I rewatch it today. It felt like a chore, man. I walked into watching this movie today thinking, oh, man. But then I was like, oh, shit. I need to apologize. She was right.
Yeah. Because when you asked me, that was Krampus was the first movie that popped into my head, because it's our new family tradition Christmas movie. And, you know, I thought, like, if you had asked George to do this, George probably would have picked Black Christmas or something. And I really didn't want to pick like a downer horror movie or one like Silent Night, Deadly Night, where it's, you know, some kid saw Santa, you know, screwing his mom, and then, you know, it causes him to, you know, like, and I think that Krampus is deceptive. Like, you think it's gonna be, and maybe it's because of the rating, but that you think it's gonna be a bad movie, and it's not. Like, it's a, you know, it's a very entertaining, like, to me, entertaining film. And, you know, the monsters are, you know, legitimately scary. Like, that Jack in the Box is a great monster. And it's great to, like, take these kind of kids' toys, or, like, you know, gingerbread men that, you know, you don't associate at all with evilness, and turning, you know, and that angel that's like this dark, creepy angel.
The creature, like, design is outstanding in this. I'm glad that Steve brought up Weta, because obviously there's a lot of mastery going into it.
Yeah,
it's mostly practical effects as well. There's very good CGI in this. And I gotta say, one of the things that stood out, I did mention pretty much everyone whenever we went into, like, oh, why isn't the spewing all these facts about who made this movie? Well, it's a team effort, and you can see it. I gotta say, the editing, and, you know, the editing can make or break a movie. Mm-hmm. I don't think editors get praised enough. And this one is phenomenal. There's some transitions that are so simple and yet so effective. And I'll give you an example. Whenever I can't remember the name of the daughter, the teenager.
Oh,
the name of the character.
Beth.
Well, Beth is the first one that that has a running with Krampus. She's the first one to leave the house to go and see her, you know, prom night boyfriend, because we know that they, you know, whenever they go to that to his house, there's a prom night photo, right? So that it's basically establishing where they are, because otherwise you wouldn't know. And before this happens, before they go on the search for her, her entire brush with Krampus is pretty fucking terrifying. She ends up in hiding under the. And there's a lot of mastery into not showing the creature in full until the 75-minute mark, dude. You don't see Krampus in full. You don't see his face. And that should be a rule, by the way.
It's a less is more.
Less is more. And the thing is, like, I stopped the movie today to see, oh, wait a second. When is it the first time that we see his face? Because we see it around, I think, 75, 76-minute mark. This is a 90-minute movie, if you take the credits out. And that's how it should be done, because it's your third act, dude.
Yeah.
It contributes to adding on to the hardest magic trick to pull whenever you're making a movie, which is landing this fucking plane. It's the third act is the most difficult thing to do. So I thought that was clever, at least. So I want to see more from him. I mean, last time I heard from anything about Michael Dougherty, I was watching one of those Talking Heads shows that are on Shudder, like the top 100 movies or whatever, and he's always very entertaining. Michelle, have you seen him? Discusses something. Mm-hmm. Isn't any of those documentaries on Shudder? He shows up, Michael Dougherty, and he's fucking royalty. Anyone that goes to Fright Fest has Trick or Treat at least in their top 10.
Yeah.
So the guy has made what, two, three features, four features? Yeah, pretty much.
I think he's got – next on his boat is Trick or Treat 2, isn't it?
But the thing is, he's reached a level of notoriety and status that is, you know, it's a milestone to do it with just a small body of work. And by small, I don't mean, you know, irrelevant or not relevant enough. I mean, just the number of movies he's made, full features. Yeah. So that's and he seems very humble as well. So I quite like him. Any favorite sequences that you guys have? Any favorite scene that you really enjoyed in this one?
The kitchen with David Koechner and the gingerbread men, where he's fighting off the gingerbread men. I find that's probably my most, that I think is the most entertaining part. Is
it gets saved by Rosie, the dog that he put down at the beginning of the movie, right?
Where she eats. Well, it's like, if you want to have an attack dog, why would you have a bulldog to, you know, like, why don't you have a German Shepherd or something like that if you're wanting a dog for protection?
They're strong dogs.
But not one that you would associate with being an attack dog.
If you had
dog,
a bulldog
though.
Trying to hump your leg, it's fucking terrifying. It's happened to me. And it was my fucking boss's dog as well. So I was just standing there going, and it was literally moving me around the room, dude, while it's trying to fuck my leg. It's super uncomfortable. But they're quite strong. Yeah.
They're all muscle.
Yeah.
Quite literally.
You have to submit. You have to submit to a bulldog. No, I won one. They're ugly and cute at the same time.
Umba,
and,
you got
Steve, your favorite sequence?
I was just going to say Umba, your favorite sequence, but mine has to be when they're chasing down in the attic, where they've got basically the angel, you've got the bear, you've got the robot, everything happening all at once. It's manic, and it's so much going on in that scene. There's about, I think there's 5 to 6 different set pieces in that one scene, all happening at the same time. And it's beautifully filmed. It feels cut to perfection. The editing is so sharp on it, and it makes you feel like you're in that scene. And
it does,
chaotic.
And it's also, it's placed in... it's a good set piece for where we are in the movie as well.
Yeah, yeah.
There is a problem here. It's not really a problem, but it was a problem until I accepted the ending, because I perceived it in a different way and it had another layer. I'll tell you what I mean.
Okay.
First of all, we should praise the animators of the... whenever Omi is telling the story of what happened to her when she was a child, that entire stop... motion sequence reminded me of Coraline. I don't know if you remember Coraline. It's a phenomenal story, and I love how she starts it as well. I think I wrote it down. First of all, I love the very ominous way in which she's advising the rest of the family on how to survive this with the very little she knows a lot, but she doesn't let out too much at the beginning because she doesn't want to be called crazy, basically. It feels like she had to live with the burden of this knowledge all her life. And there's a moment in which she goes to her son, she goes, "Keep the fire hot." Like, and she says it like fucking Werner Herzog, which is great. Yeah. when she starts the story, she goes, "It started with the wind." And then the story starts. And it's perfect. It's like it feels, and she makes the movie feel like a fable.
Yes,
you know, which is what this is. It's a folk tale. It's a fable. She's an essential character in this. I'm actually going to obsess and look for some of her work from the beginning of her career.
I felt like that sequence was actually referring to World War II, or at least the end of World War II, and
it is directly after World War II.
Where the story is talking about how her village was in the aftermath of the war. And I felt like that was handled, you know, making it into like a children's story. Like you could still tell that's what it was, but it wasn't too much.
I understand. It's alluded.
Yeah.
Because obviously they didn't want to take the movie in a different direction. There is, I think, I think I know where you're going with this because, and I, it's a point of view that I never examined. There's a documentary, quite controversial, but it's, there's heart. There's a lot of heart in it. So Steve, I know you've seen it. Michelle, I don't know if you've seen it. There's a documentary on Arnold Schwarzenegger on Netflix. And I suggest you watch it. It's, you know, you see another side of Arnie, and you also get a little bit of perspective about things that you never think of, because obviously Europe is still living with the specter of World War II, you know, and how romanticized that war was on all sides, and what it put Europe through.
Yeah.
You know, regardless of the rise of, again, extremism now, when it comes down to far out crazy political ideas, it means that we've learned nothing. But the point of the matter is, there is a moment in which Arnie in that documentary very candidly speaks about how his father dealt with coming back from the war and the aftermath of the effect that it had on the entire country when it comes down to what they were promised, what they were, you know, people turned to alcoholism, people would, you know, argue with the spouse continuously because they would have PTSD. And this is back in the 40s, in which you didn't have a, there was no way to diagnose this, you know? So the people that would suffer the most would be either a spouse or a child. And in this case, that's what I was thinking of whenever she tells the story. But I don't know, this movie, you know, the first time I watched it, it washed over me like, Krampus, kooky, crazy. But there's much more to it. Now, Ricky is not with us. However, I spoke with him this morning. And Steve, you don't know this because we had this conversation while I was trying to get you awake to do the other recording. Fair enough. Not your fault, mine. I had a conversation with Ricky and he couldn't help it but giving me some of his perspective on this. And I could hear in his voice that he wishes he could have been with us today.
I know.
You know, he's got shit to do tomorrow, so he couldn't. He's in Australia at the end of the day and the time difference wouldn't allow for him to join us. But he mentioned something that really, I didn't even pay attention to it. If you look at the junket for this movie, all of the promos available, usually for the home market as well, or the posters or whatever, there's always a reference to the snow globes on it. It kind of gives away the ending.
It gives away the ending straight away.
It does.
Yeah.
And Ricky pointed this out to me. I didn't fucking realize until he said it today. I'm like, oh, dude, we need to give you credit on the show. Even if it takes away from Michelle's research. And what she was going to post this with.
That's okay. I don't care.
Let's look, we don't want to spoil the movie entirely for our listeners, but Michelle, this was your pick. And I want you to talk us through how you perceive the ending of this movie and what it means. But before you do that, there was a part of me that wished this movie faded to black at a different time, like 10 minutes earlier, prior than the actual ending. And if it did end that way, it would have been a completely different movie.
Well, you said you don't want me to spoil it, though.
No, you're gonna spoil it. We're going to talk about
it. Okay.
The ending that I didn't, I went, oh, okay, it's cookie cutter, but it's not really. When you pay attention, it's not really. It's also quite unsettling. But the ending I would have gone for, it's much more dramatic, which is when Max is left completely alone. His family's been decimated, and he has the Krampus bubble, the teen bubble. And it fades to black, and you think, fuck, the movie's over. But that would have been much, much darker than... however, tell us about the actual ending of this movie, because it didn't end where I wanted to end. So,
For me, I thought the ending was pretty straightforward, and it wasn't until I started doing research that I realized that it actually can be interpreted as having a happy ending instead of having, like, I just figured they were, you know, it was kind of like a Groundhog Day thing where they're kind of stuck, you know, because he was saying, I just want Christmas to be like it, you know, I want Christmas to be like it used to be. And so Krampus actually grants his wish, but since Krampus is evil, he can't make it. You know, he can't fulfill the wish in a happy way. So he fulfills the wish in, okay, you're stuck together for, you know, on the Christmas day for the rest of, you know, eternity,
which is fucking terrifying.
But hell. I guess other hell. People see it as that it's just like the wish is granted and Krampus is keeping an eye on them, that like the snow globe is actually his way of monitoring them.
Yes.
Afterwards, because since Key opened the gift that was the bell, it's kind of the same way Omi was given the bell, that it's as a remembrance of, and they all, you can tell they're all kind of thinking about it, that they all kind of vaguely remember what has occurred to them. And
there's a moment before that one. And the moment that fascinated me on this viewing, because I didn't pick up on it last time, I wasn't really paying attention maybe. When Max wakes up and he goes to the living room, he's relieved because he's realized that he was just dreaming, okay? But then when the bubble comes out, he has the realization, the camera's on him, so we get his set of emotions. But then the camera pans across the room, and slowly you start seeing the rest of the family who was exactly in the same position. That's the scary part of it. That was the moment which, oh, shit, this is... And it's not easy to do because there's not dialogue.
No.
They're all acting with their eyes, and it's a very subtle performance led by Toni Collette.
Yeah.
Because you get... After we get Max's response, the first person of the family that starts reacting puzzled, and then... She goes through a set of emotions. She does all of this just with her eyes. It's phenomenal. And then the rest of the cast tries to catch up with that. But what you get when you get the shot of the entire family, you get this moment of it's and it kind of ends before it's confirmed by them what they're feeling. You know, but the idea is that they were all on the same boat, exactly on the same boat. So I don't know. To me, that makes the movie much fucking darker.
Remember, Krampus only takes, he never gives.
Hey, that's a great slogan.
Yeah,
it is.
When
it
they is. Show the snow globes at the end, the director said that his house, they made his house and some of the other crew members and things like that, like made their houses in some of the snow globes. And they're actually, the Bates Motel is actually in the house for the Bates Motel is actually one of the snow globes too. It's tough to catch, but it is. But if you know enough of remember what the house looks like, you'll see it. It's towards the very end. It's kind of front and center,
now.
And actually when the blizzard starts, kind of the houses. The Amityville house is on one side of them, and the house from Christmas Vacation is on the other side. I couldn't pick up the Ferris Bueller house, and I guess the Halloween house is in there too.
In there as well.
But I couldn't find them when I was, you know, when Beth's running around and stuff. I couldn't figure out which house was what.
Yeah,
Steve.
So it's not just I believe there's other famous houses, including one from Home Alone in there, isn't it?
It would be for sure.
There's all these little hints at all the different horror houses.
I'm gonna have to look for Nakatomi Plaza. I'm gonna have to look for everything. I'm sure it's in there somewhere.
but all these kind of little in jokes.
Especially
Christmas movies.
There's during the credit sequence. There's a lot of Polaroids of family photos. Are they the crew, the cast and crew?
I liked that. I thought that was a nice touch.
It's generous, you know, and I think it gives like a visual, it's a visual way to pay respect, because these days, man, you get Marvel movies with just like 50 minutes of credits and you are struggling. Like, we have friends that worked, Steve, we have friends that worked on special effects and whatever. It's impossible. There's like a million people working on these fucking monstrosities.
I've got one friend who worked on some huge practical effects for Marvel and Lucasfilm and stuff like that. And every single time we've sat through the movies, I've tried to try and find his name.
There's thousands of people listed. It's like a fucking memorial for the Vietnam War or something. Like it's
crazy.
Really, yeah, I don't know. Like, I understand that, you know, they have massive budgets, but these people must get paid. It's a huge amount of cast and crew. Like,
it's an industry, you know. Mate. That's it.
It's accountancy work for productions of this kind must be a fucking nightmare. even wage control, just to pay these people. It would just be a never-ending process. It's a nightmare. Just, I don't know. I would like to go back to a time in which you would have a more sizable, because you can actually connect and bond with these people. When you have 2,000 people working on a movie, you might as well be strangers. You know, yeah. It's, but anyway.
Hey, and on that note, I'm just going to say a big shout out to Keith. He's a listener. So, hey, all right.
What did you say to Keith?
To Keith, this is your credit, but I can give to you because I can't usually see your name on the screen.
Okay, Keith, we would love it for you to support us on the Patreon that we're about to set up. Before doing that, you can just make a PayPal payment to Steve. It's fine. Just a direct payment. You don't support the show. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Michelle, you picked this movie. I think, you know, we're getting to ratings here. What are you rating this? You know how to do this already. So tell us what you think about this movie.
I think I would give it 8 gingerbread men. Oh, my, I think that's 8 out of 10. 8 out of 10 gingerbread men. I thought about this a lot, and like it does, like in my heart, because I love it. You know, it's like it's a kind of a 10 in my heart, but it does have some flaws that I can't put it on the same level as something that, you know, like Dead Alive or, you know, where I...
Man, 8 out of 10 is a high score.
You know, because it is an extremely enjoyable movie. It's a movie that I've seen a million times. And when I was doing the research for this, there were so many things that I hadn't caught. It's a very, very good movie.
It is.
Yeah.
Okay, so 8 gingerbread men. Well done. So you would definitely recommend this movie?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
You would put...
Well, I don't know about that.
Niece
but,
and nieces to watch it.
I did risk you never asking me to do the podcast again by choosing this movie because I really didn't know, you know, but... When you were first talking to me, because you were like, don't choose a movie that's too obscure and don't do this. And Ricky was like, choose whatever, pick whatever you want. Like, pick whatever you want.
Pick whatever you fucking want.
So I figured you guys, you trusted me enough to let me choose. So I felt like I had to go.
Don't get used to it.
So I felt like my gut was telling me that this was the movie to go with. And over all the things that I could have chosen, Rare Exports, if I wanted another kind of dark Santa movie with the folklore kind of aspect. Like I could have gone with something like that, or Black Christmas, you know, or Gremlins. And my gut told me to go with this one.
I'm glad you picked this. Steve.
Okay, this is a solid 8 again. This is a Christmas movie for me.
Holy shit, man. 8 out of 10.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And the reason I say that is this has been on my Christmas list, quite literally, every single year for the last 5 years, I think, maybe 6 years. So every year we get to watch this. And I can watch it with my eyes closed. I can just hear exactly what's going to happen, and I still watch it.
Nice one.
And I'm going to give it 8 burning Christmas presents under a fiery tree.
Nice one.
Nice.
I think Anna is a qualified like fire marshal for her workplace. Whenever they're putting out the tree with that sequence with it, she goes, "Yeah, that's not true. You wouldn't be able to put out a fire that size with it." And I'm like, "How? Why are you bringing plausibility into this? Can we just watch this monster Christmas movie? Can we just? I don't want to hear about health and safety. Can we just
health and safety on set? Yeah, but
nice
yeah.
one.
The 8 burning Christmas presents under a tree, which very is nice. On fire. Yeah,
very definitely. Nice. I was gonna give this a 7 originally, actually even lower, but this morning's viewing was thoroughly enjoyable, and it highlighted that I can be a judgmental asshole because at the end of the day, I know you know. That's why you're here. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm glad you picked this movie. It's now a 7.8, which is massive on my personal algorithm.
Yeah.
And I am also going to reveal to the world that doesn't give a shit because it's irrelevant to what I'm about to state publicly. This is now on heavy. It will be on heavy rotation for me for Christmas from now on.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you picked it. And on that note, this was Umba.
This was Steve.
This is Ricky.
What the fuck?